From Akron, Ohio, this is episode 211 of On the Tropes. On this week's episode, following our rectangle table discussion of documentaries, we are going to talk about our top five documentaries of all time, and then we'll play a little game. But first, as always, I'm your host, Nick, and today I'm joined by...
Sir.
Eva.
And Kyle.
So I think we're just diving on into it.
Nice.
I believe. Kyle, what is your number five documentary of all time?
I guess I'll start off by saying that these are just the first five that came to mind for me. They are kind of are in order, but they're not like, I'm not saying that these are like the greatest five that I've ever seen in my life. But my number five is Dogtown and Z-Boys, a documentary by Stacy Peralta, who was one of the Z-Boys back.
He was one of Z-Boys?
Z-Boys back in the 70s. And it's just a really fascinating documentary about like the history of skateboarding. And like, I just love the rebellious nature of it all, where they started out as surfers, and then when the waves weren't big enough, they started to like branch off into skateboarding. And then at first it was just them going slaloming down hills, and then they started going like off ramps, and like they would search for pools in the neighborhood. And it was an example of having really great footage, because they were doing something that no one else was doing at the time. So they always had a camera person with them. And it's just really interesting. And I'm always a big fan of like the evolution of something, starting off slow and then kind of like where it ends up eventually. Like, that's why I love the Social Network and stuff like that. So, great documentary, good soundtrack, and really is created by someone who's basically just a skateboarder. Like, he's not like a seasoned
vet. He wasn't a filmmaker who chose to make.
He lived it, so he knew what to show and what to not show, and it was, really interesting. Eva, what'd be your number five?
My number five is Milius from 2013. Milius is an example of a lot of other people telling a story about John Milius's career, because he is unable to really communicate that to people any longer. I wonder it seems to be, by the way the film is set up, that he had a stroke while they were working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk a little bit about his recovery at the end. They have him talking a little bit at the very end, but it's mostly his kids and people he's worked with talking about him. I just love it. It's on Pluto TV periodically. If I catch it, I'll watch it.
I've never seen it. I think it used to be on Netflix. I don't know if it's still...
It was on Prime for a long time, too.
Oh, maybe that's where it was.
Yeah. It's certainly worth watching. He talks a lot about his life as a surfer also.
That's cool.
Sir, what's your number five?
Well, I talked about Ken Burns pretty late last episode, so I'll just start with Ken Burns.
Yeah.
I think that, like, it's Ken Burns is probably the most, like, I guess, like, relevant to my childhood almost. Like,
oh, definitely.
There's probably one other documentary that I'm going to mention that's more, that was a bigger childhood documentary. I mean, the Ken Burns, like, the Civil War one was huge when I was a kid. It was...
The Civil War one's the big one.
Yeah, I mean, and it was such a huge cultural event.
Yeah.
From what I remember, it was kind of a big deal.
Totally.
Who's the guy, the historian from it?
Shelby Foote.
Shelby Foote, man. What a
name.
Son of a
scoundrel.
Wow.
Yeah. He really is.
Talk about...
Well, it's like Shelby Foote's book that Ken Burns used as his primary source for the film. His spurious
book. Whatever. Yeah, that's what's cool about it, though, is like Ken Burns is like... I mean, his documentaries are pure art.
Mm-hmm.
They're...
When his use of historical actors to read characters, like actors are playing historical characters in the film.
And it's like, they are deeply historical. There is a lot of great information in them. At the same time, there is very much an element of him trying to tell a kind of a beautiful story about these maybe either mundane or events that are like too big, subjects that are too large to seemingly tell a story about.
When his whole thing is America, right? It's always something about America.
I think it is always that. I'm thinking about, the one I mentioned last week was the baseball one.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, of all of them, I think my favorite one, because I think it is the most Ken Burns, because he's talking about baseball, yet the documentary as a whole, the entire series, is very much about America.
Mm-hmm.
It's about American culture. It's about American religion. Really, I have a theory that baseball is the most American thing. It has the most American values.
Is that like, one of the Keith David
cheating,
ones or the Peter? Is that one of the Keith David ones or the Peter Coyote ones?
I don't think that's Peter Coyote.
Yeah, that one's not
Yeah,
Keith David.
I think it's Peter Coyote for sure. And it's just, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful documentary. There's so much philosophy in it, and it's so telling, like, about just who we are as a culture. And I think that's where documentaries have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were saying, it's that overarching theme. Nick, what is your number five?
My number five is a movie I just watched a few days ago. It was one of those movies, like, this year is all about for me. Like, I spent so much of last year trying to catch up with stuff from the decade that I hadn't seen before, that 2020 is all about, like, those blind spots that I've had, that are movies that everyone talks about. That I've never seen before, and this was definitely one of them, and it is 1994's Hoop Dreams, which is it's on HBO right now. It's a 3-hour documentary from the early 90s, and it's about two students who, it starts as they're beginning freshman year in high school, and they both have dreams of becoming basketball players, and they both go to a school just outside of, or it's like outside of Chicago where they live, far enough that I think they say they have a 3-hour like round trip just to travel to this high school so that they can, you know, be on a better basketball team and hopefully get to, you know, college scholarships and play in college and then eventually get to the NBA. And while the movie is ostensibly about the two of them, like, trying to become better basketball players, the movie is really about so many other things. So it's about their families. Like, the one kid's dad ends up getting a drug problem, and he leaves the family and then comes back. The one kid becomes a dad during high school, and it's about him trying to become a better parent than the dad that he had. It's about the obsession that these kids have with basketball and how those change over time. The one kid who's actually more successful in the school because he is able to stay in the school sort of becomes disillusioned with basketball, it seems like, even though he's able to turn that into getting a scholarship. And the other student ends up only staying in the high school for about a year because his family can't afford it anymore. So he gets kicked out. But he ends up becoming more successful in terms of his high school basketball career, mm-hmm. actually goes a little bit better. But it's about how their coaches, and especially at the like better school, how that coach doesn't really care about the kids at all. He just sees the kids as something to exploit to have a better team. There's actually a scene where Spike Lee is talking to, there's like a nationwide thing of, I think it's 100 high school students go to this basketball camp and they're trying out for scouts and they're trying to become better players. And there's just like 20 seconds of Spike Lee talking to them. And he basically says, none of these people care about you. Mm-hmm. Like all they see is how much money you can make them.
Mm-hmm.
And don't ever forget that. And the movie's 3 hours long, and that's only 20 seconds of it. And that's all you need, just so that it's in your mind the entire time of, that's so much of what this movie is about. It's about gentrification and how their lives are affected by that. Like, they have to travel all this way. And it's about friendship. Like, these two kids, they were not even on the same team when they went to the same high school together. And it doesn't show them interacting with each other until the end of their senior years, like over 2 hours into the movie. And when it shows them together for the first time, it's always been like cutting back and forth between the two families. When it shows them together for the first time, they're actually like good friends. Like I think it's when the one guy gets knocked out of the playoffs and like they hug and the one guy's crying and he's like, "Oh, I love you, man." And he's like, "I love you too." And it was so shocking for some reason. This movie really, really blew me away. And it has a reputation for being this good for a reason. Mm-hmm. I thought it was incredible. It's 3 hours long. I planned on watching maybe an hour of it and then going to bed. And I ended up watching the whole thing because I just couldn't stop. So Hoop Dreams is my number five. Nice. Kyle, what's your number four?
My number one was actually baseball. So I can talk more about that. Just awesome documentary. Very long, though. Mm-hmm. Ken Burns doesn't like to edit a lot.
It just
shows like he is a master of just like research. The fact that he can do a documentary not only about the Civil War but also baseball, like, and like he just knows how to show off something and I don't know. I love just watching those old, the very first episodes of the baseball documentary and seeing like why certain aspects of baseball are the way that they are, like the distance of the bags and like the creation of the leagues and the teams and then eventually like star players coming out and all that stuff. It's like really fascinating and all the footage that goes along with it. And then the fact that it's being told by really interesting sports analysts and stuff, it's really cool.
Yeah, and I like that it's sports analysts, and then he does the thing he always does where it's people, some of whom are not sports, like I think there's a couple politicians in there, there's a couple comedians
who are just
like
serious baseball fans.
Billy Crystal.
Just people who are and they're telling about what baseball actually is beyond this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know?
Or people, there's some politicians also, like people who are notable in American culture for some other reason, but instead they're here talking about going to a baseball game when they were a kid a player that they really loved.
Like, yeah, really personal.
I don't know if George Will was a sports writer, but he's definitely like a conservative politics writer. He's in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they are really long and they're really soothing. I used to fall asleep to Ken Burns documentaries. It's like after you've seen all of them.
That being said, the extra innings version like makes me a little sad because it's just mostly just about like steroids and stuff that kind of like the crappy modern day stuff. But the history of baseball is really interesting. Eva, would be your number four?
My number four is something that I think we threatened to talk about in our discussion and never really got to, and that's concert footage.
Yes, that's going to be my number four.
It's not going to be the same one.
It might not be.
It's definitely not going to be the same one. So this is one that is just a camera in the back of the room watching a concert. And it is a film that was released in 1981 of a concert from 1978. And it's some of our local heroes. And it's The Cramps live at the Napa State Mental Hospital.
That's my number four. No.
No, it's not.
But I know who The Cramps are.
It's The Cramps, and there was another band, I think it was like The Mutants or something, had a concert in a mental hospital, like in the like one of those cafeterias that has a stage at the end of it. And it seems like there's some people who aren't patients in the audience. Like maybe some people like knew there was a concert at the hospital and they went. Mm-hmm. It's mostly just kind of patients just standing there. Somebody like wanders onto the stage and takes the microphone away at one point and starts talking into the microphone. I think the film itself is from a time when VHS tapes were kind of like hard to find, or there was an effort made to have the weirdest thing you could find in your VHS collection that you could show to other people. Mm-hmm. And this is an artifact from that. It's really not, there's no narration. There's no interviews with the band afterward. There's nothing. It's just a couple of songs and then it's over.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Sir, what's your number four?
News from a Personal War. So it was 1999, directed by Katja Lund, who was a co-director of City of God. And City of God is this great film about the favelas, the Brazilian ghettos. And it really, it focuses on what life is like for Black and Latinx youth there. And just an incredible movie, incredibly like life-changing movie. I think I called it the best movie of our, if we mentioned that, best movie since Kyle was born, and that was, I think, our number. Was that the overall?
It was the group's number one, your number one, my number two.
Yeah. And I had this cool special edition disc from, and it was like, I think it was like the Brazilian disc or something like that. And it had this great documentary called News from a Personal War on it, that it was essentially like a parallel documentary to the film, where they interviewed people who were like real in real folks who lived there in the favelas, real like criminals. One of the guys that you were saying reminded me off air actually was in a mask as they were like interviewing him. And it just was really like stark and very, I remember, you know, by then I'd seen like, I grew up watching a lot of documentaries, yet that one, I think more than a lot of things, really hit like really close to home, just because, you know, for one, having just seen the film and immediately afterwards, we're like, oh, I watched this documentary, and it was just like, wow, how much of it was real and how much of it was still like happening. Because the City of God covers like a 30-year period. Mm. And it was just really, I do remember that too, being like one of my first kind of like my, like it really pushed me to start thinking about kind of like the global nature of oppression and worldwide anti-Blackness and things like that. And it just was really like important to see like how everybody in the diaspora was affected by some of the same things. And yeah, just a beautiful documentary. It's one that I really like, I don't know how available it is. I bet you could probably buy a copy. I'm looking at the IMDb page. I don't know. If you could track down that City of God special edition, then that might be the best way. I don't know. Yet it's really heartbreaking. It's moving, and it's a really good companion to the film.
Yeah, I think it's probably only available on disc, maybe on YouTube, but I'm not seeing it like on any of the streaming sites, according to Just Watch anyway.
So yeah, listeners, that is News from a Personal War, 1999, directed by Katja Lund. Nick, what is your number four?
My number four. I too am going with a concert film. This is my favorite concert film. It is directed by Jonathan Demme, who made Silence of the Lambs, and it is called Stop Making Sense, the Talking Heads documentary, which we just rewatched the first maybe half hour of the other night. And David Byrne is just the most energetic, like, weirdo. Like, he's
at
just
least from the shoulders up.
Yeah, he's just like a goofball. He dances around, he goes crazy. The movie starts with him, it's just him, huge stage, acoustic guitar. He brings out a little boombox and he goes, I'd like to play something for you. He's playing the boombox, and that does the percussion to Psycho Killer, and he does the rest of it, and he runs around stage and he's a madman. And then the next song, the bass player comes out, and then they wheel in the rest of the stage, like the drums and everything behind him. And a few songs in, there's a whole band, and he's just the most like kinetic dude. I love all these songs, because I've heard, like, I've listened to the album a million times before I even saw it. I love the Talking Heads. He's such a kinetic performer, and the whole band is like, they dance around and they're all like kind of dorky, like they're all just art students who happen to make this great band, but they seem so genuine. Like, you feel like their band practice is probably the same as what they're doing on stage. There's a time when he just like starts doing laps around the stage.
Yeah,
and the way it's put together too, it seems like they must have had a number of cameras shooting them, and the way it's cut together just feels really, it feels more like a movie than a concert, where you get close-ups of the face and you're cutting to people's hands and you'll have wandering cameras, and it's just beautifully shot. I love the movie, and just seeing David Byrne for an hour and a half be. Just like fully invest himself into performing these songs is such a delight. So I thought about a couple other concert docs, but this one had to be my favorite of the concert docs. So that is my number four, Stop Making Sense. Kyle, what is your number three?
My number three is a movie that I watched for the first time just a few days ago in prep for this. And I thought it was pretty interesting. It's called Camera Person. Kirsten Johnson.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it. I own it.
It's different. There are a lot of parts of it that I was just like, okay, this is a little strange. This is what I was talking about before with the memoir,
mm-hmm.
where these are deleted scenes from documentaries that she's worked on.
Yeah, she's a cinematographer.
For strictly documentaries, I think. She's worked on Michael Moore movies.
She has her first... she directed her first narrative that just played Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
But until now, she was just a cinematographer for docs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's basically just like these mini vignettes where it's like 5 minutes or so, and she goes to different places, and they range from being just like people dancing to like a sporting event to
boxing.
Like really personal interviews where some of them they want to be anonymous, so she's just filming their hands and like they're talking about like why they're at some clinic and getting help or whether they want to put their kid up for adoption or something, and you'd see them like their hands like moving, and like you don't need to see their face to know what they're going through.
And that's
a case where the rawness of her being behind the camera but also talking to them at the same time works, because it's almost like you're behind the scenes with her, and like this moment does not feel edited or faked or anything.
Yeah, and these are all basically I don't know if you said there, it's just deleted scenes, basically stuff that got cut from other movies that she worked on.
It's crazy to think that some of the, like the one where it's the they're in like the courtroom and they're going over evidence for the James Byrne. It's James, not Byrne. James.
I can't remember.
But yeah, it seems like crazy that whole interview would be, or a lot of these interviews would be like cut. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting.
That movie brought up a question that I had on my list of things to ask on the last episode, but didn't really come up in a natural way, but it's whether filmmakers should intervene on stuff. Because there's a scene in that movie where...
Oh, with the kid and the axe. Yes. Oh, my God. That was like... And you could hear... I don't even know like what she's doing there. But basically, she's filming these little kids. And one of them... the kid's got to probably be... Well, the little one is probably two.
Yeah.
If that. And then there's a 5 or 6 year old, and they're outside, and there's like a big pile of wood that's chopped, and then an axe that's inside a split log, and the little kid like wants to pick it up. And then the 5 year old's like kind of making sure that they're not touching it. But meanwhile, he's like still cutting at the log, and it's so intense, and you can like hear her. I think she's like,
she goes, oh my God.
Yeah. She has the same reaction that I would have had. Like, oh man, like
you need to put the camera down.
Yeah. But it's nothing like actually happens, but you feel like the way she's filming, and like she like zooms in, and like it was like so tense.
Well, I have like, for some, I don't even know why, anytime there's an axe in a movie,
something's going to happen.
I have the most, like, somebody's going to slip and hurt themselves.
Yeah.
Well, like, the whole time I'm watching The Witch, I'm waiting for that dad to gut himself. Every time they showed him chopping wood, I'm like, okay, this is going to be when he slips.
It's one of those things where, like, I film things all the time, and I would have had that exact same reaction that she had. And it was like I was there with her, and it was such a crazy moment.
But she ends up not doing anything about it. And it's interesting because the other movie of that, it's another recent movie. It's actually nominated for Best Documentary and Foreign Film, Honeyland. We talked about it. There's a couple scenes where they're like, the kids are playing in the river, and one kid like almost drowns. And I think the camera operator is too far away to do anything about it anyway. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are closer, but they don't even move. And the kid just like starts drowning in a river until like somebody else pulls them out. Jeez. And you're sitting there like, what the fuck am I watching?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to remind yourself that if you were actually watching a snuff film, they would have told you up front.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just another one of those questions about like, in terms of the fiction of the film, like how much duty does the camera operator have to like put it down and dive in, or like just put the camera down and grab the axe out of those kids' hand. And like, in that case, nothing bad happens. In this one, the kid is underwater for a few seconds. Like, that's not great. Yeah. They didn't die, but you'd like to think that the camera operator at a certain point would.
Yeah.
Right. Hopefully you don't feel like you have more of a past to would not stop. Intervene because you're holding a camera.
But then in shows like Planet Earth, they're told explicitly, like, no matter what you see, you just can't fuck with wildlife. You're not taking food out of another animal's mouths, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't do anything. Don't do anything.
Well, it's like that one show, I don't even know if it's still on, but like My Crazy Obsession. Like when people are like doing drugs and stuff, or they like they relapse or something. Yeah, it's like you're just filming them like killing themselves, and it's nuts. Anyway, Eva, would be your number three.
Related to my fourth pick, this is another VHS oddity. It's from 1986, and it's called Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
Nice.
Heavy Metal Parking Lot is exactly what it sounds like. It's footage from the parking lot of a Judas Priest concert in 1986. And it's what I love about it is there's no way that any of the kids who are being filmed could have known before they got there that they were going to be in a movie. So it's not like they were like, okay, I'm going to wear my nicest, my coolest jacket. I'm going to wear my favorite t-shirt. I'm going to talk about, I'm going to act like
this.
I'm
going to not talk about the statutory rape situation that I'm in right now.
Right, exactly.
Hey, I'm headed to the Navy.
Exactly. Like, there's no way that the people participating in it could have, and most of them are too drunk to really, like, create a character.
Yeah.
It's a very pure cross section. And it's edited. You know, the filmmaker chose which parts to show and which not to, or to arrange them in a certain order. But I think it's free from a lot of
artifice. It's something. You should really check it out.
That's cool.
It's that same kind of thing of just found and it just is what it is.
Yep. He just went to that concert and just walked up to people and said, "Hey, how's it going?"
Yeah.
What's that's Jersey Shore one we just watched?
Wildwood, New Jersey, which was another thing that I almost had on my list. And that's a related one. But for that one, it's a female filmmaker and she's interviewing like teenage girls who live at the shore for the summer. They like get summer jobs and like four or five of them will share an apartment. And the things that I like about Heavy Metal Parking Lot, I also liked about Wildwood, New Jersey. It's so like quaint now for us to see like youth culture without cell phones.
Yeah.
You know, that these are people who are interacting with each other like in the moment and not thinking as far ahead about how it looks in a photograph to other people, how it appears later, how it appears to people who aren't there. And we'll never get that again, I don't think.
Oh, definitely not. Yeah.
That reminds me, I can't remember what it was called, and it may not have been like a real, or like a something that got a wide release. And I think it was a short, but I remember seeing it online. Jake showed me. It was a short documentary that sounded similar to Heavy Metal Parking Lot, only it was Juggalos, and it's just about like people like hanging out outside of an Insane Clown Posse concert. But it's really interesting
because
Juggalos are pretty interesting people.
They're incredibly interesting, but
I wonder what it was called.
I can't remember what it's called either. But
it's really interesting.
But there's probably a lot of them.
It's one of those things where they seem like you have this idea in your head of like what that must be like.
Yeah,
but they're all like very pleasant. Like,
well, I thought it was interesting.
They're so
about
like
it.
Nice and friendly.
Well, I don't know.
I've known some pretty decent juggalos.
Yeah, there's a couple. Maybe it wasn't the same one. Yeah. Speaking again to the statutory rape on the.
Yeah, there's usually a lot of.
There were a couple of things on the a couple of juggalo documentaries or whatever I watched that I'm like, wow, they probably shouldn't be filming this person being harmed.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I think what's funny about them is like, it's kind of like with Juggalos, you expect, like, oh, we have this idea of them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's true. Yet, there's a lot there.
There's a lot of solidarity.
There's a lot there. Yeah. There's, like, quite a bit going on in that space.
Yeah.
That is...
But it's just another one of those, like, subculture movies that I think are cool. Because otherwise, you don't know anything other than the most, like, base stereotypes about people.
So, what's your number three?
Well, I want to talk about Wildwood in Jersey for a minute and just how great that movie is. So, listeners, you can find it on YouTube. It's, like, one of the best slices of of, like, youth culture from, what was it, 1979?
Oh, no, 94.
94?
Yeah, that was 1994.
Oh, my God. What about the girl who is
the, like, girl who killed somebody?
Yeah. Well, you said when you mentioned about the cell phones, one of the things that stuck out to me about that and Heavy Metal Parking Lot was the stuff that they said and the incidents that they relayed. Like, they talk about fighting on the shore a lot.
Yeah,
and
that I'm one, like, girl fought a lot.
Yeah, to the point where she killed somebody.
Yeah. She might not actually, I think she might have almost killed them.
No, she said she killed her. That she got away with it.
She did get away with it.
Yeah, she was like, hey, they didn't, you know.
They didn't charge her.
And
she was like 16. Like, she's got a lot of her life ahead of her.
Yeah, it was just really amazing to hear them talk about stuff like that. That would have been, like, when they talked about getting in fights on the shore, those would have been fights that were filmed that now would be on somebody's phone.
And that now then, would get you in trouble years later for something you did as a teenager.
There's no footage of that. And there's even, it even touched on that in the documentary because they talked about different generations of people who'd gone to the shore.
Yeah, they do interview some older people too about their time there.
So that's my runner-up pick. It's Wildwood, New Jersey. What are we on, number three?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go with probably my childhood favorite, my favorite documentary of all time as a kid. And it was 1992's Eternal Enemies, Lions and Hyenas, narrated by Powers Booth. I think this is probably, like, the greatest, one of the greatest things that National Geographic ever did. Like, you'll learn so much from this movie about life, about, like, how to be a hyena princess, how to take over a lion tribe, like, everything you need to know. And as a kid, I was like, this is, like,
I remember a lot of blood, a lot of animals covered in blood.
Oh my God. And it is so gory. And, like, speaking of, you know, Kylie mentioned the whole thing about not interfering. There's a specific scene. That was the first time that I'd ever heard about that concept, because we were sitting there watching it, and, like, the lioness, she's about to have her cubs, and she has the cubs. And then you just see, like, oh no, it's me, the cobra. A cobra shows up.
Jeez.
And they're just like, well, the cubs are all going to die. And because we're documentary filmmakers, we can't do anything about it. And they even said, they were like, you know, you might be tempted to
make a noise, try to scare it,
No, cobra comes in, poisons every one of them, kills every one of the babies, bites the mom. And then it's just, like, this super dramatic thing of her, like, it's like, da 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 da. And she's, like, trying to, like, basically live through this poisonous
snake bite.
The snake bite, and she finally makes it and makes her way back to her pride, and they, like, comfort her. And the amount of emotion that they were able to get into all these,
to,
like,
extract.
Yeah, it was just incredible. They all have names and stuff. I still remember all of their names almost. And yeah, it's just what an incredible thing. And thinking about it, like, do they put that same kind of energy into, like, every single National Geographic, like,
not anymore,
hour long documentary they showed on Sunday night? Like, it was really incredible, and it had Powers Booth. So, Nick, what's your number three?
I feel like David Attenborough does, like, with his productions.
That reminds me of that scene. I think it's the newest Planet Earth where that one.
It's like a lizard.
It's a lizard trying to run away from all the snakes.
They edited that together and used music so that it would be reminiscent of Fury Road.
Yeah, it's incredible. Or
like,
or
I'm not joking. Scene, at least the music was inspired by
it's a lot.
The Fury Road.
There's another scene that's like a mouse running away from a hawk, and it, like, the hawk's circling and, like, gets it down on the ground and starts, like, walking around, and, like, the angles that they have, it's so terrifying. It's awesome, but. Anyway,
My number three is an Errol Morris movie called The Thin Blue Line. This is a documentary from 1988, and it is the best of the true crime genre, I think. It is about a guy in Texas who was convicted of murder and sentenced to death for killing a police officer, and he was in jail for 12 years, said he was innocent. And it's about Errol Morris kind of exploring the events of that night, the events of the trial, and how the trial was not very fairly done in a lot of explicit ways, including somebody else who committed the murder. But I think, if I remember right, part of it was that the jury really wanted to have Randall Adams, the guy who is falsely imprisoned, they wanted him to be the victim, or to be their victim, to be the one prosecuted, because he was an adult, and in Texas that meant he could be sentenced to death, whereas the guy who seemed like was probably the guilty party could not, because I think he was 17 at the time.
Hmm.
So it's a lot about how the justice system is deeply fucked up. This is the movie that I think makes the best use of reenactments because they're really beautifully shot. A lot of it is like the moment of the shooting in from different vantage points, and a lot of like slow motion police sirens in the background, camera work that are really stunning to look at. And then the end of this movie, I think, has something that has probably been spoofed. Like, if you are familiar with it, you'll know it. It's the other guy who did it ultimately confessing to Errol Morris. But instead of it being an interview on screen, it's the camera showing a tape recorder playing their conversation, which is like a really cool way to depict that. But it was also functional because it was supposed to be a regular interview, but the camera broke. So he just had to use a tape recorder instead. But the other reason that it's a great movie, but it's not just that it's a great movie. It's that because of this movie, that guy actually got released from prison. Like, because of this movie's popularity, a year after it came out, they kind of like threw out his court case and he was set free. So it's a really good movie. The score by Philip Glass too. It's good. Nice. Kyle, what is your number two?
My number two is just Indie Game, the movie. Probably my favorite video game documentary, just because it's not like full of drama or anything. It's just interviewing a bunch of indie developers and them how they make their games and the process to go through, like, them being released. Edmund McMillan and releasing Super Meat Boy, Jonathan Blow and Braid, Phil Fish, who's like a big dick, and developing and releasing Fez. But it's like emotional and cool and interesting, and just shows a different side of video games that not a lot of people see or know about. So it's interesting.
It's called Indie Game?
Indie Game, in the movie. Yeah, it's really cool. Not too long, I don't think, and like well edited too. But yeah, one of the big things is just like the release, the lead up to the release of Super Meat Boy, and how it like changed their lives forever. You know, it's really interesting. Eva, what would be your number two?
My number two is from 1988. It's called Cannibal Tours. I only saw it once, and it like imprinted itself in my brain. I saw it as required viewing for a class I had in college that, there was like a film like every 2 weeks. We had to go downstairs in the basement of the library and all check out and watch together. And, this is my introduction to post-colonial theory. And, it's about a tourist group, white tourists who go to Papua New Guinea to see the cannibals. And the way that the film is constructed is we have this question of who's primitive, who's civilized, who's a cannibal, who's cannibalizing something in this, and who is not. And the film suggests that this, the people who live there are putting on a show for the tourists, that they're showing things, parts of their culture that aren't actually meaningful to them at all, really. And they're doing it as a means of survival for themselves. This is a way for them to make money. But it's, you know, the point for the class that I was in was that, you know, you have these two groups that need each other just as equally. And so that, like, watching it, I just remember being like just so angry. It's so embarrassing to watch. It's so frustrating. It's so ugly the way that these people are acting, of like touching people's hair, making children stand next to them to take pictures, and just so angry like the whole time. And then like when we got back to class and we were talking about it, my professor goes, he goes, "So, you know, some of that was made up."
No.
It's like, nice. the filmmaker kind of like constructed some of that and wouldn't tell us. There's kind of a narrative around the film that it's accepted that some of that is directed, but he won't say which part. He won't say if it was him telling the people in New Guinea or if he's telling the tourists. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of up to you to figure out which is which. I was just so irritated. I was so mad. And I was like, fuck this. I'm over it. But I mean, the movie's 30 something years old, and there really hasn't been I feel like there should be more of that. There should be more of a critique on this kind of, especially now that that kind of tourist culture is really accessible to a lot more people. And there's so many people who are making their own like YouTube videos or travel blogs or things like that. We should have that kind of criticism, and we just haven't really had enough of it. Can't get enough of it. Cannibal Tours. Nice. The one thing that I really remember is one lady at the end who's like leaving the village, and she's carrying these like statues that are phallic symbols, and just like the symbolism of like, oh yeah, we're completely taking everything that makes this culture powerful or useful. We're just going to take that with us. Now it's time to get back on the boat. Sir, what's your number two?
Well, now I'm going to move into the section where I copy Nick, and I have actually four more picks.
How's this like the thing that's affiliated with me?
You love your ties.
I infrequently do ties. I don't do ties.
But when you do it five at a time.
Yeah. Well, you're only doing four, so I feel
so.
Like.
This double feature is 1971's "The Murder of Fred Hampton." Which is a documentary film about the short life of the Black Panther activist Fred Hampton. And during the film's production, Hampton was fatally shot in a pre-dawn
raid,
police raid.
And, is it police or like FBI?
Police, Chicago police. I should say pre-dawn murder. That's what it really was.
Yeah, it's an attack.
And the movie is like, because of that, is just stark. I mean, for one, it's 1971. So it's very, I have another documentary that deals with that time that was made later in the 90s. That's a good double feature for it. Yet the murder of Fred Hampton is the people that it happened to telling you what happened as it's literally happening to them. And it's, I can't really speak enough about how powerful it is. I think that Fred Hampton as a civil rights leader is somebody that hopefully will begin to get his due. Just an incredibly brilliant person, and really would have fit in really well with the kind of like progressive
ideals that we had now. He had to be
right,
killed.
You know, and I think that is the documentary. I mentioned it last week's episode. Where they play clips of the trial. You get to hear him actually talking. You get to hear people talk about how he was what separated him from the rest of the other folks. I think he was 23 when he was killed. It's hard to kind of say what's all great about it. Like, I would just watch it. That's an incredibly amazing just as a documentary and as a historical document. The other one is the FBI's War on Black America, 1990. And it has some other names like COINTELPRO, FBI's War on Black America. You might be able to find it on YouTube. That's another one. If, like, basically the next four documentaries, if you want to know anything about the Black civil rights struggle, like, these are the four that I would recommend as being the most important. I think the FBI's War on Black America is really important, just especially in today's day and age, as we start to become worried about the power that states hold and how that power might be used against citizens. It's important to know what's happened already within our institutions and what's already kind of gone wrong. And it's just one of the best summaries of the 60s and 70s movement that I've ever seen. So yeah, great documentary, and it's available for free on YouTube. Nick, what's your number two?
Well, number two, speaking of cannibalism.
You're welcome.
This is a movie I've talked about on the show, I think a couple times before, called The Emperor's Naked Army Marches On. It's a Japanese documentary. Mm-hmm. And it follows a guy who was a World War II veteran, and it's like 40 years later. I think it takes place in the 80s. This is a guy who is very angry and has tendency towards violence. He tried to assassinate Hirohito by shooting pinballs at him with a slingshot. It didn't work, obviously. So it is about him going around to old people that he knew from the army and trying to figure out what happened to a few fellow soldiers of his when they were stationed. I can't remember where they were stationed, but it was in a place where it was like towards the end of the war, they were stranded and cut off, and there were questions about whether some of the soldiers were killed and cannibalized. And it's about him going to meet different people, and at one point he hires actors to play family members of one of the dead soldiers because he couldn't get their actual family to do it. There's a part of the movie where he's interviewing one of the old army officers in his house, and he gets mad and just like attacks the guy in his home. So it's a very heavy movie, but the guy's really compelling to watch just because he's got like such this righteous rage against, you know, for good reason, against these things that happened during World War II. So it's difficult to find. I saw it on Mubi years ago, but it's not there anymore because they cycle through their movies. I think there might be a DVD copy of it, but I don't know if it's region free or not. But it's a fantastic movie. Kyle, what is your number one?
My number one is a documentary I think I've mentioned before on the show, and it's just the 9/11 one by the Nade brothers. Mm-hmm. Such an interesting
Loose Change.
Oh God. Showing our age.
What I thought, so I watched this in when I was at film school in a documentary class, and I just thought it was so interesting how they went out to make just a documentary about this engine in New York, firefighter house, and about this new recruit, and it was the summer of 2001, and then they were just like, when 9/11 happened, they were checking out some like gas thing on the street, and then you hear it, and like they're filming while the plane hits the World Trade Center, and one of them like looks up and they see it from ground level hit the building, and then the entire documentary just changes. It's like about, I don't know, how heroic all these guys are, and it's not the prettiest documentary because it's just them filming everything that's happening from the ground level, but it's insane and like dark and raw, and it's crazy. There is talking heads in it, which is fine, but it's not as interesting as just like seeing and being there in the moment. It's like they don't pretty it up at all, and it's crazy. So
who is it directed by?
They're the Nade brothers.
Okay, so it's because there's a few movies called 9/11. This one's from 2002.
Yeah, 2002. There's like a version of it just on YouTube that you can watch. But yeah, it's crazy. I was just checking it out the other day just to like remind myself what it's like. And I like got sucked into it again. It was just like crazy. Yeah, that's my number one. What about you, Eva?
My number one is Harlan County, USA. Harlan County, USA should be required viewing in schools.
It should be required viewing, like I said, before watching the TV show Justified.
Yes. Kind of similar to Kyle's, where it was intended to be a different documentary, and then events turn it into something different. The filmmaker was making a documentary about the United Mine Workers Union, and right before the events in the film, there was actually an election for president of the union where the guy who was the incumbent hired people to kill his opponent. It was Jock Yablonski. So she was making a film about that and the aftermath of that. And then naturally Tony Boyle, you know, couldn't run, and the push to have like a rank and file member be the president of the union. So that's what she was doing. And then found out that there was a strike happening at this plant, at this mine. And she turned toward this film about strike that went on for a year. And the showing the houses that people live in that are working for a mine that have no bathrooms. There's a campground shower and toilet facility in the center that everybody uses. There's a scene with a woman who's given her kid, who's not like a baby, looks like a kindergartner, first grade age kid, a bath in a wash tub that the little girl's too big to get in. She can't get her feet in it. And she's telling her, she's like, well, when your daddy gets a contract, we're going to move someplace that's got a big bathtub and hot water. This is 1972. And having a bathtub is a luxury that we don't have yet, but we're going to get one. And there's a lot has been said in the last like 10 years in this country about like white rural America turning toward really like dangerous policies and turning toward people that, because they're frustrated because they lost their jobs and
economic anxiety.
That's all bullshit, because if you watch Harlan County, USA, you will see a cross section of people who are like as young as teenagers and as old as 70 and 80 year old people who are talking about that the place that you work for doesn't care about you, you know, that they know it. They all know it. There's not this romantic image of a coal miner that they try to push now in West Virginia and Kentucky that. No, it's a dangerous and shitty job, and a lot of people died doing it.
And they say you have to work until you get black lung to get any health benefits.
And you have to keep working even when you're sick, so that by the time, if you quit, you're disabled enough to get assistance, because you're not going to be able to get another job. And the film focuses a lot on this women's group that's adjacent to the men who are actually working in the mine, who are like widows, wives, and mothers of the miners who are organizing on their own, on their side, to support the strike of getting people into it and talking about things that we often don't give people in that part of the country credit for thinking about. It's a lot. That's not my childhood. However, there's enough of my childhood and the way I was raised and what I was raised to value that's similar enough that it's like personally useful to me or powerful to me. And it's just a really, really important film that not enough people have seen.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it until a week or so ago when we were like talking about doing this episode. That was one of the movies that I'm like, I need to catch up with this, because it's one of those things that I'd always heard about and was always like, well, I'll get to it eventually, because documentaries, I'm, for whatever reason, like end up a little bit lower on my like list of things to do. But I made time for this, and God, it's so good. There's a scene, I think it's towards the beginning, where a guy is talking about how little valued they are by the coal mining companies. And he said if they were down there and like things were starting to collapse or whatever, and they had a donkey down there, they would be like, make sure you save the donkey because we can't replace those. We can replace the people.
Humans.
Yeah, we don't care about the people.
Yeah.
Because they're very easily replaceable, but the like the animal labor is not mm-hmm. replaceable. So it just shows, I mean, how these big companies just didn't give a fuck.
Yeah, I love the part where they're picketing at the stock exchange. Mm-hmm. And
is that when the cop comes up to
them? One guy's talking to the cop and he's like, you know, like your subway tunnels. He said, our tunnels are only 42 inches high. And, you know, we have to, they show him in the beginning of the movie getting on the belt line mm-hmm. and riding in. You have to lay flat on your stomach and tuck your arms in because they're not going to waste the time of blowing out a tunnel big enough for you to stand up in.
Yeah.
You can just do it tall enough for the donkey to get in. And he's telling the cop about that. You know, I go down in the tunnels and work too. And the cop's like, yeah, but I'm not going down where you work, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's like talking to him about how much money they make. And the cop's kind of like,
really? He's like, you guys are getting screwed.
He's yeah. Like, and he's telling him, he's yeah. like, that's really bad, you know. And then the guy's name is Jerry, is the guy that he's talking to. And he says, but it's actually a good job. That's the thing that we, for where they are. Mm-hmm. In Kentucky, that's a better job. That's a better wage than, like, nobody's doing it for fun. You're mm-hmm. doing it because it makes enough money mm-hmm.
yeah.
that it's an improvement over something else. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fantastic movie.
Sir, what's your number one?
So my number one pick is, well, I've got two. My runner-up is Who Streets 2017, directed by Sabah Folion. And it's about the killing of Michael Brown in the Ferguson Uprising in 2014. Just really intensely personal for me. I was there and it was really just amazing to watch this footage and see it on screen. My number one pick is 2016's I Am Not Your Negro.
Oh, and the James Baldwin.
Yeah, yeah, it is one of the greatest. I mean, it's my number one pick. There were so many documentaries that I thought of that there's no way that I could name all the documentaries that I would recommend. Yeah, this is the one that just stood really tall. I'm just going to read the synopsis. 1979, James Baldwin wrote a letter to his literary agent describing his next project, Remembering This House. The book was to be a revolutionary personal account of the lives and assassination of his close friends, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr. At the time of Baldwin's death, he left behind only 30 completed pages of the manuscript, and filmmaker Raoul Peck envisions the book that he would have written. So essentially it's all James Baldwin's words. Mm-hmm. And it's footage of that time, the subjects, and also a lot of commentary about the state of Black America in general, both then, before and then now. And it's just intensely personal. You get to hear from somebody who was not only there, who was living next to and in conversation with all the people that we kind of grew up hearing about. And James Baldwin, obviously one of the greatest intellectuals we've ever had, one of the best writers. So it's just a very beautiful and haunting and moving informative documentary. I can't recommend it enough.
My number one is on our next recording session, we're going to talk about La Jetée.
Nice.
My number one is a documentary by the guy who directed La Jetée is mostly a documentary filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of his most famous documentary. It's called Sans Soleil. They're actually like the Criterion Blu-ray of La Jetée is La Jetée and this movie.
Without which is, sun?
Yeah, it's sunless. It's French sunless. For sunless. So it's a, on its face, it's a travel documentary where a guy goes to, the main places he goes are Japan and Guinea-Bissau, but he also goes to Cape Verde, Iceland, Paris, San Francisco. He goes all around. And it's just footage of him going to those places. But the way it's presented is it's a female narrator reading letters that the filmmaker had wrote to her.
Mm.
But they're not real letters. It's all just made up. And the camera person is billed as Sandor Krasna, so he's credited as the writer and he's credited as the cinematographer, but it's really just Chris Marker using a fake name, and he is presenting it as if it's letters written to this person, but he just like wrote up stories basically. So it's just him kind of like philosophizing about these different areas, like these different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
but I just love the way it's presented, and there's a lot of just kind of like quietly philosophical things that are said in passing. So my favorite quote from it is, the quote starts with, "He wrote to me," because this is the woman narrator actually saying, "He wrote to me, I will have spent my life trying to understand the function of remembering, which is not the opposite of forgetting, but rather its lining. We do not remember, we rewrite memory, much as history is rewritten. How can one remember thirst?" And I think about that all the time. How do you remember thirst? Like, when you think about writing, like, how is that something that you can actually, like, remember and describe and recount? So it's just things like that. And he talks about memory, or they talk about memory a lot in this movie, which I think is interesting because that's a theme that comes up a lot when we talk about La Jetée. Memory comes up quite a bit. And also the playing with the format where it's a documentary, but it's also like letters that aren't a documentary at all. It's totally fiction.
Yeah.
So it's kind of blurring those lines between documentary and fiction, the way La Jetée also blurs lines in how it deals with genre and how it deals with filmmaking itself.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of something that I wanted to get to in our last episode when we just talked about what is documentary, but we didn't. Like the blurred lines between documentary and other genres, it's almost like, is Midsommar a horror or is it a comedy?
Yeah.
And you could do the same thing with documentary almost. Like, is this movie really a documentary or is it a drama that's meant to look like a documentary? So I think that's kind of an interesting way to look at stuff. So Sans Helaya, it's my favorite documentary. I love it.
Nice.
We have one more round of the X meets Y game.
Did he split these up? Like, is there a theme for each round or no?
This is Rubber Meets Road. So it's getting a little harder. There are three rounds, and then Die Hard on an X is the bonus round. So we'll get to that in a future episode. This is round two of X Meets Y from John Ducker.
I don't know if I'd be as good as Cyrus.
Creature from the Black Lagoon meets Splash. I'm guessing that is Shape of Water? Yes.
Yeah.
Starship Troopers meets Groundhog Day?
Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah.
Clue meets Your Next. I never saw Your Next.
It's like a
Ready or Not, maybe?
It's
Ready or Not.
Ready or Not.
It's from this year.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, is that the one who woman who gets invited to a party or something?
I think it's her wedding.
But she's like meeting her family for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. But a podcast I listened to paired Clue with Ready or Not. Nice. Close Encounters of the Third Kind meets Contact. Those are already kind of similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Arrival.
Yeah.
The Birds meets The Room. That's Birdemic, Shock and Terror. It's got to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
No, he just called it Birdemic, not Birdemic, Shock and
Is Terror. Is that really the full name? I guess
it's
the full name.
Man. It's a Mad, 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 Mad World meets Smokey and the Bandit. I'm guessing that's Cannonball Run. Yeah. Monty Python meets 1984. Brazil.
I was gonna say, what's that movie you guys love that I couldn't stand?
Brazil. LA Confidential meets Fast Times at Ridgemont High. It's gotta be Brick, right?
Yeah.
Chinatown meets Looney Tunes. Who from Roger Rabbit?
Yeah.
Blazing Saddles meets Rush Hour.
Wild West? No.
What's the isn't there a Jackie Chan and Owen Wilson one?
It's not Wild Wild West? No. That's Will Smith. Shanghai
Noon.
Noon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hostel meets The Wicker Man. I'm not going to get this one. Saw? No. Oh, we mentioned it recently. Oh, all right. I get it.
Torture? Or is it not Saw?
It's Midsommar.
Oh, yeah.
Or Midsommar, depending on.
Yeah.
RoboCop meets District 9. Chappie?
Yeah.
Yes, Chappie. And Jaws meets Twister.
Sharknado.
We did pretty good.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We got there.
I think it's funny how, like, when you say that the two movies, like for the most part, it really clicks a certain movie.
Yeah,
which is interesting. That would be a tough trope to cover, though.
Yeah, yeah, is like an episode. It's more fun as a game.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was our discussion on documentaries. You can find the show at facebook.com/onthetropes or twitter.com/onthetropes. You can subscribe to us and rate us on iTunes. That'd be cool.
Mm-hmm.
You can get some loot at onthetropes.redbubble.com, and you can subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/onthetropes, where I have my top 100 movies of the decade.
Nice.
And coming up soon, we're talking about La Jetée. So that's available on Criterion and Canopy.
I heard you like that movie a lot.
I do. I think it's also on YouTube.
La Jetée? I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm pretty sure. It's pretty short. It's only 28 minutes long. So if you want to see it, haven't seen it before, I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube. Although, if you have Canopy or Criterion, I'd watch it there.
Because it's all about the graphics.
You'll get the sound. Alrighty. I've been Nick.
And Kyle. Oh, yeah. Where'd the other two go?
They disappeared into the documentary void.
Oh.